Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Oklahoma Perspective. The Human Rights Watch has finished its report on Tulsa law enforcement. The report was commissioned after the fatal officer-involved shooting of Terrence Crutcher. Recently, KRMG's Russell Mills talked with John Raefling with Human Rights Watch and Tiffany Crutcher, Terrence's twin sister.
We are here with Dr. Tiffany Crutcher and John Raefling. John is with Human Rights Watch, senior researcher. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Wow, I can't believe I remembered that. And Dr. Crutcher, twin sister, correct, of Terrence Crutcher?
Yes, that's correct.
And can you tell folks a little bit about what you're doing now besides, you know, dealing with all of this? You're also live, I think, in New York, is that right?
Actually, I live in Montgomery, Alabama. There approximately 15 years, and I decided to come back home in December, this past December of 18, because I felt like this movement and my family's fight for justice needed me more. And so I've been on the ground here for approximately 9 months.
Okay, so you're back in Tulsa.
I'm back in Tulsa, and I fly back and forth just to check on my home there that I built.
Okay, so let's start with, I mean, I don't even know where to start. This thing is so huge. And I first sat down with John, when was that? It was March. It was way back there. And we talked about this Human Rights Watch report and what you were doing. So if you could, for starters, just sort of explain to me how you came to be in Tulsa and what the goal was for this report.
Sure. Thanks for having me here, Russell. Back in September of 2016, like so many people across the country, I saw the video of Tulsa police officer shooting and killing Terrence Crutcher. And my job is to do research and writing around the criminal legal system, including policing in the United States. And this particular incident really struck me. And so it drew my attention to Tulsa, both because of what it said about Tulsa, but also because of what it said about policing throughout the country. And I wanted to look not just at the use of deadly force at this one particular incident, but let's look at what's going on with policing on a day-to-day basis. What do people in Tulsa face when they're dealing with police every day? And, you know, what's the good, what's the bad? What happened to Terrence Crutcher occurred? Is there something systemic going on with policing in Tulsa?
There are a lot of shootings of unarmed black men by police officers around the country. What is it about this particular situation that it became the nexus of this report?
I think a big thing was hearing the officer in the helicopter above saying, "That looks like a bad dude," and wondering, where is he coming up with that? What does he know about this man that he's viewing from 100, 200 feet above that he would say that? But then also seeing in the aftermath of the killing how the community responded, and how government officials responded and saying, okay, is this different? How is it the same as in other communities where these incidents have happened? Is there an opportunity to do something productive that could help with reform moves in Tulsa?
Tiffany, let me walk you through that September. You said before we started recording, it's a blur in a lot of ways. I'm sure that's true. How did you first find out about what happened to your brother?
Well, I was in Montgomery, Alabama. It was a Friday evening, I was at a restaurant waiting on a friend, getting ready to have dinner. And I received a call from my cousin, my first cousin, who lives in Dallas, Texas. And I was excited to hear from her because I hadn't talked with her in a while. And she said, "Have you called home lately?" And I said, "No, I hadn't talked to my parents in a day or two." And she paused and she said, "I think you should." And I said, "Dee Dee, what's wrong?" And she wouldn't say anything. I said, "Spit it out." She said, "Something has happened to Terrence." And I said, "What?" She said, "I heard he was shot. And I think he's dead." And my entire body went numb. And I immediately tapped out and left the restaurant and got in a car and started driving. And hadn't heard from my parents at all. And I said, "Well, how would she know way in Dallas, Texas?" And my parents who live in Tulsa, they haven't called me. So I didn't know if it was true. I was praying, hoping that it wasn't true. And my hands started to shake on the steering wheel and I decided not to go home. And I went to a friend's house and asked if he would just start praying with me, praying that this news I received wasn't true. And about 45 minutes went by and I'm pacing back and forth. And then finally, after an hour, I started receiving phone calls from the 918 area code. And my phone was blowing up, but it wasn't my father or my mother. And I said, "I will not answer this call," because I didn't want to hear that on the other end. And finally, after an hour and a half, my dad's number popped up and I was afraid to answer. And my friend said, "I think you should." And when I picked up the phone, my dad was on the other end, hysterical, screaming, "They killed my son. They killed my son." And he was at the hospital and he said, "They are treating us like criminals and they won't let me see my son." And I said, "Who killed Terrence?" And he said, "The police." And I lost it. I'm not sure what happened after that, but it was, you know, I'm the only girl, you know, and I have three brothers, but to hear your father, your hero, on the other end of the phone crying and screaming hysterically, it does something to a daddy's girl. And I had to try to get it together. And I started calling family members and some of my mom and dad's closest friends saying, "Hey, can you get to the hospital and take care of my parents? I'm over 900 miles away." And I was getting ready to get in the car and try to drive home. And my friend started coming over who lived in Montgomery and said, "You're not in a state to do that." And so we got a plane ticket and got on the first plane smoking the very next morning.
And I guess your folks were just in shock. They were just...
They were in shock because the last time they saw Terrence was earlier that Friday. Terrence stopped by the house to drop my parents off some money because his daughter, his youngest daughter, was celebrating her birthday and was getting ready for a slumber party that night at a hotel. And he was dropping off the money for the room. And then he was really excited because he was headed to Tulsa Community College to start his first day of class, a music appreciation class at the Northeast campus. And so, you know, they thought that everything was fine. And then after that, he would meet them over at a church workshop, a music workshop, where he sang in the choir. And to get that news, from what I heard, that's where they were teaching music. And his sisters, my aunts, walked in the church and broke the news. And they said that they lost it. They lost it.
Well, and I think most people would, because it was just a shock, just, you know, stunning. So what's been the focus for you here? I mean, we put a little bit of time between that event and now, and you have, like you said, moved back to Tulsa. You've started the Terrence Crutcher Foundation.
Correct.
What is the goal of that foundation? Because something you said to me on the phone the other day resonated, which is that, you know, Terrence's death is going to mean something.
Absolutely.
And that is what's driving you right now. That's what I got from that.
Absolutely. Terrence dealt with struggles, many struggles over the years. And we did everything together growing up as twins. We were part of a junior orchestra. We were a part of a jump rope team. They didn't separate twins. Whenever we went on a field trip, they made us sleep in the same rooms. And so we did everything together. And then, of course, I moved away after college. But we everybody knew about the twins, Terrence and Tiffany. Very different. He could sing. I couldn't. But we both love God. I know that. And so we turned 40 August 16th, 30 days before he was shot and killed. And we had a really long conversation because Terrence lost his right eye back in, I think it was 2002, if I'm not mistaken. And he went into a deep, deep depression. Deep depression after losing his right eye, almost lost the other eye. But it was spared, and he dealt with some hearing loss. So he was pretty much disabled. And so going into that deep depression from that trauma, he turned to drugs and became addicted and struggled with that for many, many years. And we prayed, and, you know, he was in and out of rehab, and he prayed, but he found himself in church every single Sunday, every week, singing and doing what he loved, you know, which was singing gospel music. And so on our 40th birthday, we had a conversation and we talked about how grateful we were to be alive and to go through what we've been through, because less than 2 years before Terrence was shot, we lost our oldest brother, Joey Jr., to stage 4 colon cancer. And we both spoke at his funeral, and that really hurt us as well. And so he said, I'm going back to school. I'm excited about it. I'm going to make you proud. And his last words to me were, God is going to get the glory out of my life. And I said, I believe you, and I'm excited. And I'm excited about our next 40 years. And 30 days later, he was gone. And so a lot happened that first year. I mean, the trial came around pretty quickly. Betty Shelby was acquitted. The jury penned a letter stating they didn't think she was blameless and she shouldn't be a patrol officer. And we had to figure out how to move forward, especially being a faith-based family, you know, a family that grew up in church, my parents being ministers. We had to try to stand strong on that faith. We had preached to everybody else, but it was very difficult. And so we picked ourselves up and said, you know what, we're going to cling on to Terrence's last statement. And we're going to start a foundation in his name. And so we decided to turn pain into purpose and start giving scholarships to people who were struggling like Terrence, who was trying to overcome, or who's trying to overcome and intentionally get themselves together through education. And that's what we did.
Because that's a tough slog. Once you're in that world of drugs, and I've got some experience on this. Once you're either arrested or incarcerated and you're trying to rehabilitate your life and start over, man, it's tough.
It really is. And, you know, what I know as a healthcare provider, and I know that no one who's addicted wants to be addicted.
Right.
That's what I know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you think about the disparities and when you think about or talk about race as it relates to addiction, we know that when you're black and brown in America, addiction means criminality. And then now, you know, fast forward, because all of these black men, they're in jail because they may have been addicted to marijuana or some type of drugs, or and they needed help. But now we have this big opioid crisis on our hand, and people are addicted to those drugs, and it's a health issue. Why? Why is that? And so those are some of the things that we really need to think about when we judge or criticize people who are addicted. They're not addicted because they want to be. Of course, we all have to make decisions and choices in life. But I remember one day I was coming home and I saw Terrence lying in my dad's lap, a grown man. And you know, Terrence was a big teddy bear.
He's a big old guy.
Yeah, well, you know, he's not as big as what people think or what they said. You know, he looks like a bad dude. And, you know, Betty Shelby thought he was larger than life and that he was 6 foot, 300 pounds. Terrence was only 5'9", 5'10", 255 pounds. And so, but I came home and I saw my twin in my dad's lap crying, saying, "Dad, I want this off of me. I want this off of me. Help me. Pray for me." And so all we knew to do was to pray and just keep loving on him. And he didn't get a chance to accomplish the things that he wanted to accomplish because his life was taken because somebody thought he was a bad dude.
So, John, let's talk a little bit about, she touched on, you know, if a white kid gets caught with pot, they're probably going to get a ticket. And this is, I'm going back years and years. Much more likely for a child of color to be arrested, or even an adult. I guess it really doesn't matter. The Equality Indicators reports that Tulsa has done for the last 2 years show pretty clearly that there is a definite statistical difference in the number of people with colored skin who get arrested. There is a, 11-year difference in lifespan expectations if you live north of I-244. So this report, and it's what, 216 pages long, goes into a lot of depth of that. Talk a little bit about what your findings were, and obviously we can't go into a great deal of detail, but did you see some of those disparities, and were they, do you think, driven by race?
The disparities are undeniable. We found disparities in poverty and all of the sort of negative outcomes around poverty. We saw unemployment in the black community considerably higher than in the white community. We found life expectancy, substantial differences, you know, all the things that have been, are being talked about in Tulsa, the lack of access to healthy foods, all these things contribute to an ongoing cycle of poverty. And one of the other negative outcomes of poverty, and poverty very much concentrated along racial lines, is this aggressive and at times abusive policing. And that policing often contributes to poverty. One of the sort of striking findings was just how, with every arrest or even ticket or citation, the individual arrested or cited ends up getting debt from the courts. Huge amounts. And this is a problem that's across the country. This is an issue across the country, but very striking in Oklahoma and specifically in Tulsa. Poor people can't pay. Failure to pay means a warrant, which means exposure to further arrest, which allows police to stop, arrest, search, go into people's pockets, so they're more likely to find that bag of marijuana on a poor person. And poverty and race track very closely in Tulsa and throughout the country.
Tiffany Crutcher and John Raefling with Human Rights Watch. Special thanks to KRMG's Russell Mills for the interviews. This is Oklahoma Perspective. For Cox Media Group, I'm Bert Williams.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.